You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello. Tamara here, your host on Inside Launch Street. As many of you know, this episode is brought to you by my friends over at Brility Digital, a team of business growth strategists who embrace an experimental mindset to help you meet your company goals by leveraging the right digital tools and resources. And of course, I didn't want to bring you just a shallow sponsor. I wanted insights we can use. Stay tuned for my brief interview interlude with Brility President Derek Kuhn. So let's talk about this episode and my guest, Kevin Cruz. Leadership can be such an elusive thing. And I think sometimes we get trapped in these old leadership models that don't apply anymore. I mean, the dynamics of our teams have changed, but the leadership rules haven't. Doesn't really make sense. And that's why I had on Kevin Cruz. He is the CEO of LeadX, which is the world's first executive coach built with IBM Watson AI, and the author of the book, Great Leaders Have No Rules, Contrarian Principles to Transform Your Team and Business. We dig into both how AI helps leaders and why you may want to get rid of some of the old ways of thinking, like the open door policy or treat everyone equally. Hint, these old rules also hinder you and your team's ability to innovate. All right, here we go. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today. I have a feeling this is going to be kind of a wild conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me on the program.
So tell us, what is your first memory of being innovative?
Well, my first memory, I don't know if you'll call this innovative, but I invented a robot when I was 8 years old. And being eight, it only existed on paper, but I literally have that. I drew him out on graph paper and I called him Zorko. I don't know why I called him Zorko. And I have this drawing framed on my desk even today because I was fascinated by, you know, life-size robot stuff. Like I'm an old guy. So this is like before Star Wars and stuff, but drew out this whole robot. And my father, who was like into electrical things, stuff, he claimed we were going to build Zorko, and we never did. And as an adult, I try to forgive my father, you know, for like some of the ways our parents let us down. But deep down, I'm still angry we never built Zorko.
Oh my gosh. What I really love about that, Kevin, is that you put it on graph paper, which, because I'm a product of the 80s, and if you put it on graph paper, you were more serious about it. Like it was a step up
serious.
From regular paper.
That's right.
I don't know why. Oh my gosh. And I love that you still have it. I mean, I think that that's such a great reminder that we're all innovative in some way and we have it as kids and then we lose it along the way. But to have that daily reminder must be so helpful to just make sure that you're thinking differently about things.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun.
So I wanted to actually start out by asking you about LeadX. Talk to me about its AI, its learning and behavioral change. I want to understand how that all comes together.
Sure. Well, so at the highest level, like what I'm all about is I want to scale leadership and democratize leadership around the world. I literally want to spark the next 100 million leaders around the world. And that's a big number. So I can write books and hit a lot of people at 800 million. I could do talks, all these normal things. And it was about 2.5 years ago. So I had started and sold several different e-learning and HR tech companies and had taken some time off. But then I saw how AI and chatbots and the supercomputers were being used for things like cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, mental health treatment and changing people's behaviors. And leadership is about behaviors, what we do. And it's not just work leadership. To me, if leadership is influence, we need to learn how to lead, how to influence ourselves first. How do we lead in our families? And then, of course, how do we lead at work? And so when I saw the breakthroughs in AI, I said, all right, like this is how we can scale leadership development. And so we were in stealth mode for about 2 years, and we worked with the IBM Watson platform to teach IBM Watson all about different personality theories and, you know, how to delegate, how to run effective meetings, how to coach your team members, all the normal leadership and management topics, and also how to be a bit of an executive coach. You know, we taught Watson how to help you pick a goal, create an action plan, and then to check in with you as your accountability buddy each week, which is really why, you know, coaching works so well. And so, yeah, it was actually just late in 2018 that we came out of stealth mode, went public. We call it Coach Amanda, LeadX with Coach Amanda. And so it's this, you know, it's an app. It's powered by IBM Watson that will diagnose your personality, train you in management fundamentals, knowing your personality and quirks, recommend goals, and give you all kinds of developmental things to do. So it's been a lot of fun.
So I want to ask you, there's a couple things you said that I want to ask you about. One is, and this is a little bit of a biased question because, you know, as you know, we developed an innovation assessment that tells you how you innovate,
right.
So your style of innovation. And kind of the same thing you're talking about is, you know, we all have our own ways of doing it. But if we can unlock that, like imagine how many innovators we can put in the world, kind of similar to what you're saying about democratizing leadership.
Right.
So,
right.
And I believe very strongly in this, but I'd love to hear your perspective on it. Why is understanding your personality so interesting? Integral to leadership or being a good leader versus the whole, like, you have to follow these 10 principles that everybody else is following?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at the most fundamental level, personality drives behavior for good or for bad. And so, first of all, understanding yourself, the self-awareness enables you to leverage your strengths, which you're already good at, but also helps you to modulate your person. You can't really change your personality too much, but
right.
Depending on your profile, you can have what they'll call derailers. You can derail your career. For example, one of the big five super traits is called negative emotion. It's just how do you react under stress? Now, some people have, you know, very low negative emotions, so things can be going crazy and they're just chill. They got ice water. That's their personality. Others are very reactive in stressful times. And so what you get is executives who often will reach a certain level because they're smart, they work hard, whatever it is. But this one trait in their personality, if they're not really aware of it or how it impacts them during these tough times, they're going to become a screamer. You know, they're going to scream at their people, or they're going to curse, or they're going to pound the desk, or they're going to have a breakdown, whatever it might be. So when you understand your traits and how they can go against you and hold you back at work, or the positive ones that you can leverage, you go a long way. And then the other thing to me, even more powerful, is when you understand personality theory and your own traits, you see the world a different way. And all of a sudden, you know, that person that is just really annoying you all the time at work, you don't know why these get under your skin. You're like, oh, I'm a massive introvert and they're a massive extrovert. That's
right.
Why they're annoying to me.
They you ask know, so it, many questions.
Yeah, right, right. Why are they always talking in the meetings? And that person's like, why does Kevin never participate? You
right,
know? So
right.
It just gives you a way to modulate your own communication and emotions and stuff, but also helps you to understand others a little bit better.
So the other thing you said I wanted to ask you about is you said we have to figure out how to lead ourselves first. Mm. You know, I think we often think of leadership as an external behavior or skill, I guess. Why is ourselves first important?
Well, I mean, I think everything starts with ourselves. You know, if we're trying to accomplish something on the job or the career or in our family or whatever, how we show up physically, emotionally, psychologically, it matters. So if leadership is influence, literally, I need to lead myself, you know, away from the potato chips and onto the treadmill. Mm. I need to lead myself away from that weird bachelor finale where he didn't even propose. And
you're like the third person to mention that to me lately. I got to start watching that show.
And I need to pick up a book that's gonna, you know, make me a little smarter or better. And so, you know, it all starts with ourselves. You can't help other people if you haven't helped yourself first. Like, you can't give what you don't have. So I always say, you know, start with yourself and have the energy you need to energize other people. Have the patience that other people need, you know, you to have. It always starts with yourself.
I love that phrase, you can't give what you don't have. That's such a great, I love that. That just kind of wraps it all Just kind of wraps it all together.
That's right.
I mean, you obviously have a lot of leadership experience, and you know, you poured it into the book that I just read, which is why we wanted to have you on the podcast, because it's so fantastic, called Great Leaders Have No Rules, Contrarian Leadership Principles to Transform Your Business and Your Team. But I wanted, before we dig into the book, I wanted to back up. How did you realize that the leadership rules that most of us were following were incorrect? And I'll just preface it by saying that when I first opened the book, I was like, wait, what? Really? I shouldn't be doing that. But as I read, I was like, oh my gosh, of course, this makes perfect sense. But how did you even realize, hey, all these, I don't know, I think we just assume these things to be true.
Well, yeah, I've been starting businesses, trying to grow businesses for 30 years. And in my 20s, I failed completely. Like the first two companies ended in failure. And back then, I didn't even understand that leadership was a superpower. I mean, I thought about sales or I thought about marketing. I didn't really think about leadership. When I finally discovered, like, oh, you know what? Like, it really is about having a great team and leading them right and creating that culture. I then went to some mentors who were older, and they gave me the old school conventional wisdom, which used to work at a certain time. And whether it's, you know, something, I mean, I had multiple people say, like, Kevin, you know, leadership is acting. You know, you've got to wear your mask. You can't show weakness, otherwise they'll take advantage of you. You can't get close to your people. God forbid you have to fire them someday.
Right.
You know, there's all this kind of old, you know, I'm remote and removed from everyone else. And we need rules so that, you know, people don't spend too much when they travel, or Joe doesn't, you know, unbutton his shirt, you know, down to his belly button, or whatever we think we're controlling for. Right. And so it's like, stay remote, put these rules in place to control, have a lot of processes. You know, it's like management, like building a machine. Maybe that worked at one point. I mean, I'm glad I wasn't like in my prime when it worked, because this day and age, it's different. Our cultures are different. The, you know, we're 24/7, we're connected, the generational differences, it just doesn't work. And that's when I finally figured that out, like my last couple of companies really took off and we were winning Best Place to Work awards and engagement awards and all these other things. It's because I took all these traditional things and kind of flipped them around and did the opposite in many cases.
You know, it's, as you're saying that, I'm having all these memories flood back into my life. But
from your agency days?
Yes, totally. I'm like, oh my gosh. And well, it just reminded me of one that I'll never forget. When I first got into kind of the management leadership role, my mentor said, when you're giving feedback, because you got to spend a lot of time giving feedback, right, you know, make sure that you sandwich the negative. So positive, negative, positive. Do you remember that? And I remember doing it over and over again, but not getting the behavior change I was looking for my team, like whoever the person was. It was like the negative got washed away. And finally, one day, I think I just got fed up and I didn't do any positives. I just said, hey, this is, you know, what's happening and this is what needs to change. And the person did it. And it was like this revelation for me of, oh my gosh, that whole sandwich thing is a load of, you know what?
Okay, now I'm angry that I don't have a chapter on that, because that is a perfect example. Like, this will be, hey, any listeners out there, I'm going to have a bonus chapter 11.
On the sandwich.
Yeah, contact me. It's going to be like, put down the feedback sandwich.
Oh my gosh. Do you remember that? It was horrible.
Yeah, it's a perfect thing. It used to be like, say something good, then the real thing you want to say, which is how they should improve, and then something good. And the idea was like, well, you want it to be balanced and you don't want to disengage them and all that. Meanwhile, everyone's like, wait a minute. Am I doing a good job here?
Right. Or am I don't know what to do here. So I'm just going to do the same.
Yeah. Two good things, one bad thing. I'm not sure what's going on, you know? And so, and you're right. The right way to give feedback that we now know is opposite of that. It's you just say it as close. If you see something, say something as close to the point of observation, you give that feedback. And as long as it's coming from a place of caring, like you're not, you know, trying to punish them, whether you're telling them they smell or they did a bad job on that presentation or whatever it is, they're going to realize you're trying to help them. You're trying to make them better, and they won't be confused about the message.
Right. You totally brought back memories of sitting in this office. That was horrible. So, you know, one of the best ways to do this was in order to get your perspective was to kind of go through some of the chapter titles. And maybe you can kind of share some examples around them, because some of them in particular, for me, were really surprising, yet kind of dumb moments at the same time as I started to read. But they're not the norm. So I think listeners out there, I think you're going to say, wait, what? Tell me what? What do you mean I should do that? So I pulled out three that I thought were really amazing and surprising and really powerful as I started to kind of even adjust in my own work. And I'd love to hear you talk about it and then bring up any others that you think that I didn't mention, but you think need to be talked about. One was crowd your calendar. Like, I thought I needed free time.
Right. people think they need free time, and all the getting things done, the GTD junkies out there, you know, we're taught like the calendar is where you put your scheduled things like phone calls and meetings. And then the to-do list is where we put all of our tasks and, oh, you prioritize it, A, B, C, A1, A2, all that stuff. Well, I had first discovered in the last book, 15 Secrets Successful People Know About Time Management, super successful people, they don't even use a to-do list. They just work and live from their calendar. The phrase was schedule, don't list. And when I started doing research for this book, it was a similar thing. The first was that, okay, great leaders truly value time, like nobody's business. And I'm not like a big sports guy or whatever, but like over and over again, I mean, legendary Duke basketball coach, they call him Coach K. He wrote a book about leadership. Every single his main theme was time, team building in time and moments. And every one of his chapters started with the word time in it. And then John Wooden was a coach where he said like every minute of his practices were scheduled. And it was like the, your competitors might have more money than you, they don't have more people than you, might have other advantages, but everybody's got the same minutes.
Right.
So if you can really maximize that, and again, to me, this goes back to our own lives, right? I mean, life is time. Time is life. Why do we let so many people, you know, steal our minutes away? And so, you know, crowding your calendar is about valuing the time. And if you truly value the time, you will schedule everything on your calendar, including your free time. Because if you don't schedule your free time, guess what? You're not going to have it. And so, like, you know, the CEO of LinkedIn, every day he puts 60 to 90 minute block on his calendar. That's just thinking time. Mm. You know, Bill Gates was legendary for blocking the entire last day of the week, last day of the year or week of the year. That's what I'm trying to say with think time, his think week, where he would just say, now's my time to read and think. And so otherwise we're always putting out that fire and picking up our phone, you know, responding to someone's problem. And so the idea is you literally put everything on your calendar, schedule your whole day out, ideally every 15 minutes. And if you want free time, if you want, you know, to do whatever, or even go for a walk, well, good, but just schedule it so it actually happens.
All right. I am here with Derek, who is the president of Brility. So Derek, your company Brility is amazing at helping your clients think and act differently and leverage an experimental mindset to stand out. So how does having an experimental mindset help you do that?
Well, thanks, Tamara. I would say the experimental mindset is essential for long-term success and predictable success. We are all about building a system that is reliable for growth. And to do that, you have to challenge assumptions. The experimental mindset allows us to put our best foot forward, adapt and iterate, and really learn what is causal to work so that we have predictable success. We really are in a dynamic environment right now. Technology is changing, business is changing, and assumptions need to be challenged. So in order to do that, we need to craft careful experiments where we can learn, adapt, and grow.
What's the downside of not experimenting?
The assumptions. I mean, you see Blockbuster gets wiped out by Netflix. There is a graveyard of companies out there who thought they had it figured out, and they marched towards a certain doom because others were out there experimenting and figuring out what works and what doesn't and adapting to the changing marketplace. Amazon runs 10,000 concurrent experiments at once. There's a reason they dominate e-commerce. Google does the same thing. Facebook does the same thing.
Wow. So can you share with me one example of how Brility did that for one of your clients?
We have a GIS client, which is a type of software that does mapping and locations. They are a small startup, but very, very well funded. And they're going up against a massive incumbent. And they there isn't a current name or explanation for their offering. It's not commonly searched for or known. And what we what we had to do was run dozens of experiments to see what language at a high level resonated with their audience, which were anywhere from engineers to salespeople to VPs. And through that, we really found what surprised us most was not outcome and benefit-based promises, but actual screenshots of the technology, which seemed to immediately and intuitively have the users grasp how it was utilized. And there's a shift in the marketplace that people are sick of platitudes and promises. They want to see a little bit of how things are done. Those experiments were very revealing, and we're doubling down on them for the client now, and it's very successful.
All right, launch readers, what we need to figure out, I know I'm going to go do right now, is figure out where I'm experimenting and where I'm assuming. Derek, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
You know, I think this is so powerful for a couple of reasons. Someone once said to me, and I'm going to botch it a little bit, but basically it was, you know, we treat our calendars as if it's time that other people get to fill up. When really it should, the purpose of the calendar is for you to schedule the things for you to meet your goals.
Right.
That's
right.
What it should be. And again, they said it way nicer, better than I did. But that was kind of that point. The other thing I'm kind of intrigued by in all this is what you're saying is, don't leave to-dos up to free time. If things matter and need to get done, they go in your calendar too. So it's not a matter of every minute is filled with a phone call,
right,
a meeting. And in fact, I would assume that when you do this, your meetings get minimized because there's less time.
And I'm glad you pointed that out, because I wasn't clear about it. Right. You don't just crowd your calendar with these meetings and calls. You're scheduling the tasks that you need to do on your calendar. If you really want to do it, take the time to say, all right, well, which day, which time, and how long is it going to take?
Yeah. And the other thing in there, too, you said about think time. I think when it comes to being innovative, too, if we schedule just 30 minutes in the morning to think differently, you know, and I know that sounds like, what do you do during that time? There's a million things you can do to fill that up. That actually trickles out to the rest of the day. But if you don't schedule it, suddenly you get to 3 p.m. and then you think, well, I'm too tired to be innovative or creative, so I'll do that tomorrow. But if we actually scheduled it in the morning and crowded our calendar with it, we'd do it.
Absolutely.
God, it's so interesting to me. Okay, so the other one was, and this was one of my favorites because I got more stories here, but close your open door policy. And maybe these kind of go hand in hand, but we are so trained to think my door is always open. I come in at any time. And, you know, now because I have a small business and I partially work from home, it's not as big of an issue. But when I used to be in a larger office, man, I never got anything done because people were always coming in.
Yeah, I was the same way. I mean, it would be just, you know, it always starts from a good place. Open door policy. Hey, people can communicate freely and quickly and solve problems and all that. You're trying to get work done and inevitably it's got a minute.
Yeah, right.
and it's never a minute, right? They lie.
No.
It's at least 15, maybe 30 minutes. And so again, whenever that wisdom, that phrase, open door policy, you know, it came from a good place, but it doesn't work anymore. And of course, like you, most of the times I'm working from my home office. It's not always that this is a physical door. It's getting that tap on the shoulder when you're in an open office environment, or getting that Slack message or emails or whatever, even if you're working from home. And so this idea is like, okay, we're not saying close your door completely. It's not it's not to that extreme. But the problem is that not only is the person who's getting interrupted not getting deep work done, creative work, thinking work, but Marshall Goldsmith had an interesting thing. He said, this is a bad sign about the people coming through your door. You've got to say, if this is a problem, first of all, did you hire the wrong person? Did you not give them the training that they need to do their job? Or worse, do you not have a culture of psychological safety where they can make a decision, solve a problem, take an action, and be okay with it? Do they feel like they have to run everything by you? And if that's the case,
right,
why, you know? And I had one reader who, when I was doing this research, said, hey, I don't want to walk through an open door policy because I want to talk to my boss when she's in the right mind frame, when not when she's trying to rush me back out the door or irritated that I just interrupted her. So for all these reasons, you know, I say, close your door, open your calendar. It goes back to that first one with your calendar. Think of it as office hours, and to each their own. You know, maybe it's, you know, hey team, like I'm going to try to do my deep cognitive work before lunch every day. So when my door's closed, it's closed. But every afternoon, then the open door policy kicks in. Or maybe it's like, hey, the last 2 hours of every day, or maybe it's the first hour and the last hour, maybe it's Fridays, whatever it is, have an office hours mentality where everybody kind of knows when it's okay to go through that door, quote unquote, or when it's not.
At the same consulting firm I referenced earlier, we had a real problem with that. So one of the things that we actually did was one of our themes 1 year was Sasquatch making a big footprint. And so we had a Sasquatch doll. And if that doll was on your, some of us had offices, some had open cubes. And if that doll was on your cube or hanging from your door, you were not allowed to bother that person because they were some kind of deep work. But it was a culture shift for us because it was, you know, we had always been about hyper collaboration, which I think I'd love to get your perspective on. I mean, I love collaboration, but there's a time and a place for it too.
Right. No, I agree. And again, that's a great idea, having some kind of signal to let people know, my door is closed to you right now.
Yeah, it took a little time. Like people be like, yeah, but I just have one thing. But to your point, first of all, it may be a minute, but the next person's thing is a minute. And then suddenly an hour's gone by and you haven't done anything. And I don't know if the number's 100% accurate, but I read somewhere was something like every time you switch tasks, it takes 7 minutes to get back.
Yes.
Into the flow. So I'm not sure if that 7 minutes is totally accurate, but something in there. But so imagine the time that you lose by constantly being interrupted.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's the switching cost. It takes so long to get into flow state or just in the zone, you know, whatever you want to call it. And then when you get broken out of it, it's hard to return.
Yeah. And to your point, though, also, we use Basecamp, which I absolutely love. It runs our business. It is fantastic.
I do as well.
Yeah,
I use Basecamp.
Love it.
Yeah.
However, you know, there's six people pinging me at any given time. So I have to shut it off because it's just as disruptive. Even just seeing it come across my screen, even if I don't open it up, I find is hard. Like it actually takes my mind away from what I'm doing. And maybe I'm just not skilled enough to multitask that way.
No, nobody can multitask. And it's funny because, you know, there was at least for a while that movement where, oh, well, email is horrible. So we're going to get rid of email. We'll just use messaging.
Right.
Well, it's the same thing. It just pings up on your screen, even if it's if it's internal. And so you need we all need to take control of our lives and not respond like Pavlov's dog every time it dings. And Basecamp, I do the same thing. Like it's great for when I can respond to people quickly. But if I'm writing or doing something, I mean, I just shut it down so I don't notice it, you know, in the periphery.
So how do these kind of more contrarian principles, how do they foster innovation in a team?
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, you'll tell me because I'm not the innovation expert, but in my experience, more from just an entrepreneur and, you know, now doing like AI stuff, to me for innovation, and usually as a company owner, I'm frustrated that we don't have more innovation going on. But I think that, you know, it starts with the person or the people, and, you know, you've got an assessment on it. You know, I think people have to sort of have that growth mindset and have, you know, in personality they call it high openness. It's hard to make someone who's really not innovative, super innovative overnight. But even with innovative people in this environment, if you've got a leader where there's no psychological safety, people aren't going to want to innovate because failure is punished. Failure is looked down upon. So I think, I mean, that's one thing where we're talking about leading in a way where you're building trust. You know, we talk about some of the other chapters are like reveal everything, show weakness, because authenticity, transparency, that builds trust. And then people are willing to experiment, to try things, to toss out ideas when they realize that, hey, you know, the boss failed or the boss had that dumb idea, whatever it is, like, this is okay. This is what it's about. It's a culture of experimentation. So, I mean, that there's the culture side of it. And then I would say the other side is the productivity side, which we've, you know, spent most of our time on. It does take time. It takes time to do that 30 minutes in the morning where you're going to walk around the block, or it's the long shower. Like when you're doing something else and it lets the other side of your brain relax, that's when a lot of this ideation happens. So whether you're scheduling it on your calendar or closing your door and letting, you know, giving yourself some time to work something out, I think you need all of that for innovation to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in that. I'm sure you've read the book Deep Work and kind of And I think that we're so busy multitasking all day that we never go beyond superficial. So what we do end up doing is checking off tasks. Right. And maybe not even checking them off well, but we check them off. So then we think job done, right? Job done, job done. So, right. I mean, I have my lists. We all have our lists. The challenge is we stay so superficial in our thinking because we're just trying to get through the day and everything that has to get done. I think the second part about it is, and I'd love your perspective on this too, we're seeing this all over the place. There are a lot of teams that call us, they have an innovation process, design thinking, agile, whatever, fill in a custom one, doesn't matter what it is. What they don't have is buy-in from their people. So their people are stressed and overwhelmed and don't see how they're innovative, so they don't buy into the process. So, you know, kind of what we've discovered is, hey, well, we'll help you figure out how do you get your people engaged to do whatever process you have. Because ultimately, and I think you're saying this with leadership, ultimately what most of these companies have or teams have isn't a process problem. They actually have a people problem.
Right.
And it starts with them, right, to your point about leadership.
Yes, it absolutely does. And in fact, my own perspective on this is the people problem is 90% of the problem. It's not the process problem, because you could take a bunch of innovative people in the great culture and just set them free and innovative stuff's going to start bubbling up from that. But you could take the opposite, wrong people, wrong culture, and have an amazing process,
right,
and you're never going to get a good idea. You're never going to have an innovative thing. So, I mean, I think it's 90% about letting the people, you know, realize they are innovative, they are creative, and here's how we're going to do it. And it's not about the process at all.
Yeah. I know this is a little bit obvious, but I want to ask the flip, which is, why do you think the old rules, like the open door, treat everyone equally, which we should probably get into because the play favorites, by the way, was the other one. You know, all of those, why do you think they stifle a great culture and innovation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of the answer is the flip side of what we've been talking about. You know, so if you're constantly busy, constantly interrupted, it's hard to get innovative. And if you've got a leader who's the old school command and control, don't break the rules, you know, don't do anything wrong, that's going to send the message that failure is frowned upon, experimentation is frowned upon.
Right.
But I think at a higher level, the issue is that a lot of companies haven't made the leap. So your clients know that it is all about innovation these days. I mean, innovate or die, right? And and the pace of change is so fast.
So fast.
It's incredible. But there's a lot of companies stuck thinking like that leadership's role is like to preserve what everybody has. So if you're in the mode of, oh, I'm in a big company, whatever, whether it's 1,000 or 10,000 people, and like, we're about the quarter. Like, let's provide profits on our quarterly statements and let's preserve everything. We are preserve the culture. We got to make sure nobody loses money, nobody says an inappropriate joke, whatever it is. It's all about de-risking the venture. Mm. But that's holding on to the present. If you want to thrive in the future, you have to take more risk in the present. Inevitably, you're going to do that. So, I mean, I think this, my leadership lens is about old school leadership was about safety, you know, de-risking, and that doesn't work anymore. And so that's how it ties back to the whole innovation play.
Do you think the fact that we now, I just read this article in Fast Company, it's a couple months old now, about the fact that there's five generations in the workplace now.
Yeah.
And one of the things it said that actually struck me, it wasn't about the differences of, I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm squeezed in the middle, but, and it wasn't about the difference between boomers and millennials, right? It wasn't about that. Right. It was just more a matter of fact, like we now have this squeeze in the workplace. But one of the things it talked about was, you know, it was an incredibly high percentage, like 78% of people in the workplace credit lack of communication and collaboration to workplace failure. So it wasn't about generational differences. That part actually they all agreed on. Do you think kind of that lack of hierarchy, those five generations coming together, does that impact how we have to lead today versus yesterday?
Yes and no. So we've done a lot of research on employee engagement, leadership and engagement, leadership and communication. And we see almost no variations. To your point, it's not about the generation. So we don't really see generational differences like that. But what you will see is, for example, it's just because of age. Like the millennials right now are the hungriest learners. Like they want to learn more and develop and all the rest. But they're 25 to 35. So like they're at the start of their careers. And what you'll see is people who are, you know, 55, 60, 65, they're the lowest on so growth, recognition, and trust are three big things for drive engagement. Communication is fourth. And so as you get the older generations, based on where they are in their career, they're not as interested to play in this stuff. They're not as interested in the future right. as the younger folks are. So there's, we see some variance in that, but I think it's more about age and career stage than generations.
Kevin, I can't tell you how happy I am to hear you say that, because one of the things, I'm just going to throw it out there, and I could be, you tell me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that drives me nuts is people talking about how millennials are lazy, entitled, and all this. And I think to myself, I'm pretty sure that my boss thought that about me when I was in my 20s. And I'm pretty sure their boss thought that about them. Like, every generation thinks the next generation is more entitled and more lazy than they ever were. So, yeah. I mean, and yes, things have changed and things have democratized. And like, I get all that. But there's a part of me too that goes, no, that's just being 25.
Yeah, I'm on your side with that. And I've looked at a lot of the data, even if like I've pulled out the books from the consulting companies that are selling all this generational stuff and like, oh, we did this research, blah, blah, blah. And you go back into the appendix and they're making the statement that, you know, whatever it is, you know, the millennials want X more than the other generation. And you look and it's like, wait a minute. Okay. So it's saying that 75% of millennials want more communication at work. And 65% of boomers want more communication at work.
So
everybody wants more communication at work. Okay. So that's the headline, not the headline you're putting out there. So I agree. I think, of course, you know, there's going to be age related differences, but I think it's a form of all of us screaming, like, get off my lawn, you know?
Yeah. It's more of a lifestyle, like where you are in your life stage, I guess, better way to say it. And the reason that what you're saying kind of is making me smile too, is I think for, you know, for us worried about or thinking about leadership and innovation, you know, maybe we stop focusing on, oh my God, I have a bunch of 20-year-olds, and think about, okay, what people want is growth mindset and communication overall. So how do we drive that in our culture instead of worrying about catering to one generation or another?
Yeah, right. Because we will all benefit.
Right, exactly. So I want to bring it back. Actually, before I do that, I'm going to go back to play favorites, because that was the one I skipped, just thinking in the essence of time. But it's so, that to me blew my mind. So will you talk about play favorites as one of your contrarian principles?
Yeah. So again, I was raised back when I was young and dumb, I was told, like, again, like management 101, like, you know, you can't play favorites. You got to treat everybody the same, otherwise you're going to get attacked and people will think you're biased towards somebody, blah, blah, blah.
And I think that goes all the way back to as you were kids, right? We were taught, and as a parent,
of course,
you don't play favorites with your kids. That's what you're not supposed to do, right?
That's what you're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
And I remember the day that it was actually, so I had this guy work for me named Sean, great, great leader, just innately. And he came to me one day and said, hey, I got someone who came to me who was pretty upset. She's accusing me of playing favorites. And I said, oh no. And I'm thinking this is going to be like an HR issue and all this stuff. And I said, what'd you say? And he said, I told her I do play favorites. I'm like, oh no. He
Wait, what? No, abort, abort.
Abort, abort. So, you know, he kind of schooled me in this, and I've learned from other, you know, leadership coaches that the most unfair thing you can do is to treat all of your team members the same. Mm-hmm. The most unfair thing you can do with your children is to treat them all the same. And we're not saying that, you know, we're not, when we talk about favoritism, it's not cronyism. It's not saying play favorites because you like playing golf with them on the Sunday or, you know, you guys, drink beers after work or whatever. We're saying treat people differently. You want to individualize your leadership approach. Star performers, they should make more money than the lower performers.
Right.
You should be. Now, the classic mistake that managers will make is like, I got 10 people, three are superstars, one's a loser, and there's a bunch in between. Gosh, I'm really going to spend all my time with the loser. They really need my help. I'm going to train them. I'm going to coach them. I'm going to go out on their sales calls. I'm really going to give them all the help they need. No, you don't ignore them. You give them the normal kind of management support. You will get more leverage as a leader spending time with those three superstars.
Yeah.
That's where you want to invest your time. So whether it's how you reward people, the developmental opportunities you give them, the time that you give them, you want people who are high performers to get more from you. And to clarify, like on the, again, like on the rules or the standards, it's not that you would waive a standard or rule for a top performer, but you would change the penalty. So if a standard is that, hey, we show up at work by 9 a.m. or something, and there's one person that's missed that 3 days in a row, well, then the punishment should be harsher than your superstar who's shown up early for 10 straight years, but then was in a car accident and got to work 10 minutes late, right? So even the punishments or reprimands or feedback should be tailored to the situation and the person.
That's interesting because, I have a colleague who runs a sales firm, and one of the things that she was telling me, and I think it's in line with what you're saying, but I want to tell you and kind of see what you say about it. She was saying that one of the challenges they had this one superstar, just in terms of dollars, right? They were the rainmaker. They brought in all the cash money.
Right.
The challenge is they were always late to the office, always late to the team meetings, and kind of disrespectful to the other people, I'd guess. So on one hand, a star performer. On the other hand, setting a really bad precedent for everybody else, right? A really bad example. Yeah. How do you deal with that situation?
Yeah. Okay. So this, I think, is one of the toughest situations, and I've been in it as a company owner. And so this is a little bit of like, do as I say, not as I did, because you're right. Like when you've got, so the issue is there's always leaders need to think about two things when you're growing a company. Are you getting results, and how are you getting results? So there's always the outcome and then how you got that outcome. And I had a sales professional who, again, she was delivering very, very well, top. However, she like was running her own little tribe inside the company, different culture, different rules, had a whole different thing. And it started to get back to people. It was bothering people, not on her team. Her team loved her. And I was under extreme pressure for financial results in the short term. And I turned a blind eye to it and said, listen, as long as it's not against what we're doing, we're going to support this performance with freedom. But I'll tell you what, that lasted about a couple of years. And then she resigned, stole all her team members and started her own company and took the clients. Right. So my lesson was, look, in the short term, I was killing my quarters and everybody was happy and all the rest. In the long term, it came back to bite me. And so I think that whether it's sales or anything else, ideally, you want to have your star performers, you know, being great team players. Often they're not, you know, they're kind of their own thing. But this is where like the whole idea of why rules should get replaced with like standards and values. You do need to determine what your guardrails are. And so, you know, if like showing up at a certain time and then they're late, it's black and white and it's hard, because then when they don't hit it, everybody knows like, all right, what's going to happen or not going to happen to the person. If you have guardrails about showing up, you know, at work at a reasonable time so your team can get productive and clients can get taken care of, there's a little bit more swing in that. So I always prefer conversations around standards rather than like the black and white rules.
Yeah, I really like that. And it made me realize that it's also dependent on how you're defining your high performers or high performance. So money is one thing. I mean, that's an easy example for us to talk about on the podcast because we all understand that. But also like your leadership and how you're showing up and supporting your team. I mean, depending on what your company is about, but it doesn't have to just be about one defining metric makes that person a star performer. It can also be, to your point about standards and values, how they behave. Because that impacts the company.
Yeah. And in an ideal situation, especially for non-salespeople, the annual bonus should be tied to things about the individual, the team, and the company, you know, performance, and values or behavior should be part of that, you know, measurement.
Yeah. And I just, the whole play favorites, you're right. Like, why would I treat someone who doesn't take their work seriously, does the bare minimum, the same as the person who's working their butt off?
Right. That's right.
It doesn't make sense now that you say that. I want to bring it back to you for a minute. When you think about yourself, how do you innovate?
Yeah. You had sent me this question before and I chuckled because a lot of people for the last 30 years will say, oh, you're so creative. You're so innovative. I've had e-learning companies, tech companies. I've got, you know, we just built the world's first executive coach on IBM Watson.
Yeah.
However, I view myself as very not innovative. Now, I will say on the, you know, personality side of things, I have a very high openness, high growth mindset. Like I'm an eager learner. So I'm always learning. I'm very curious. So I would guess that, you know, kind of a root of innovation is being curious.
Absolutely.
And learning. The only thing that I do intentionally, and it's not fun, but I do it intentionally, is I purposely consume like content or things that I wouldn't normally want to do. So, for example, if I'm, you know, if I'm at the barbershop, I'll look at the magazines there and I will grab Ebony magazine because I don't normally read Ebony magazine. If I'm, you know, waiting at the pharmacy for them to fill my script and there's Men's Health and Women's Health magazines, I'll grab Women's Health magazine. Netflix just released a show about Formula F1 racing, which I know nothing about.
Oh, I saw that.
And I was like, I don't know anything about racing. I'm not like that kind of a guy, but like, let me watch it. Wasn't that great? Wasn't that amazing? Now I'm like an F1 fan. Yeah. And so by consuming all these different things, I just think like, oh, that's weird. Or that's different. Or I never heard of that phrase or whatever it is. And then I purposely try to apply it to what I do. So for example, it was me reading about, mental health and I didn't even know what it was, but cognitive behavioral therapy and how they're using AI to replace human therapists. And I thought, okay, well, how can we use AI chatbots to replace human executive coaches? Coaches are a little bit like therapists. And that's how it kind of started on this idea. So anything I learn, I could be watching a cooking show and I'll say, oh, isn't this weird how they're doing a top-down camera view as they're cooking on the stovetop? That's a weird camera angle. And I'll think, can we do a weird camera angle on our training programs that we're doing? So I just try to look at weird stuff that I wouldn't normally consume. And then I pause and say, how can I apply that to our business?
You know, one of the things I most regret about the magazine industry going under and not going to the grocery store anymore, because two things I don't really do, I do all delivery, is I used to stand in line and pick up the most random magazines, like the BMX bike magazine, whatever it is. But I'm with you. And, you know, and I think what you said just really hits it. I mean, I know from our kind of work that everybody has a different way of innovating, right? We have different approaches just ingrained in our personalities. However, what I think is universally true is that people that expand their world of knowledge, even superficially, simply like they're more curious like you, have more dots to connect because you just have more bits and pieces of information.
Yeah.
So the more I think you can spread your wings in terms of what you learn about, when I kind of do the same stuff you do. And then when I travel in hotels, I don't have cable at home. That's when I watch stuff I would never watch.
Right.
And then it's mind blowing, some of the stuff on TV, but it's also really interesting. So, okay. I want to, before I ask the last question, where can people go to learn more and connect?
Wow, this has been fun. Yeah, and I'd love to connect with everybody. For people who are interested in the book, it's available everywhere, online bookstores, or go to norulesleadership.com for information about it. Or if you want to check out this Coach Amanda, you know, executive coach robot, go to leadx.org, and you can do a free trial.
Awesome. And we'll put all those links in the show notes. My last question for you is, what's the first step we can take to be great leaders?
In the theme of the book, I would say pause long enough, shut that door long enough to think about what rules at home with your kids or at work should you now have a conversation about. Which of these rules should really be replaced by a conversation about values and standards? Because people are more likely to comply to achieve the goal, whatever that rule meant, if they really are bought in. If they can talk to you about it, they're more likely to comply to it.
Kevin, this has been so much fun and so insightful. Thank you so much for coming by. Before you go, I want you to pick one contrarian principle to implement. For me, it's stopping the open door policy. It's so distracting. I didn't even realize how distracting it was. And it keeps me from getting to the important, strategic, and innovative work I need to do. You know, it's just like one more email, one more chat ping, one more convo. It adds up to an entire day. Now, hey, I want to make it even easier for you to innovate. So go to our website and click on Take Free Assessment button. You'll take the Innovation Quotient Edge Assessment and get a glimpse to how you innovate, how you add value. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.